Well, the government's new counter-terrorism law first, in preparation for the potential return of foreign fighters from Syria. The new law would give a High Court judge powers to place restrictions, known as control orders, on people who are deemed a terror threat upon returning from overseas. The police would then seek and administer these orders, which could be applied to people aged 18 and over. The Justice Minister, Andrew Little, says the new law would apply to the likes of Mark Taylor, the New Zealander who joined ISIS and is currently being detained by Kurdish forces in Syria. Of course, events of the past days mean that there are implications for the likes of Mr. Taylor, possibly increasing his opportunities to seek a return to New Zealand. The Green Party says it will not support the bill, saying there are human rights implications and the law could end up catching people who aren't actually terrorists. National, on the other hand, says the bill isn't tough enough. It wants the age reduced, among other things. University of Otago Law Professor Andrew Geddes is our guest. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine.
What's the argument for this new law, the need for it?
Oh, I think the argument for it is public safety, basically. I think the government's identified what it sees as being a gap with relation to people who are either coming back to New Zealand having fought overseas, or, we should note, coming to New Zealand for the first time from overseas, who there may be reason to think have been involved in terrorism activities overseas. But because of the problem of gathering evidence and so on, you can't really put them in front of a criminal court and charge them with those actions under our Terrorism Suppression Act. And so the government, I think, is trying to create a... It's basically the equivalent of, you know, extended supervision orders in the criminal context, where you the state is able to control and put limits on these people in the hope of reintegrating them into society and stopping them from doing bad things while they're here.
It's been dubbed draconian, even by the minister introducing it. But actually, when you read the explanatory note of the bill, we're talking about a limited time. And then after 2 years, all bets are off, right?
Possibly. I mean, first of all, it's potentially draconian in the sense that the range of orders that are indicated under the bill are quite extensive. I mean, at their very most extreme, the High Court could say you must live at this particular place, you must be in that particular place for up to 12 hours a day, you cannot have a bank account, you are not allowed access to the internet, you may not talk with these people, and so on. So the range of controls that are possible under it are quite extreme. And, I mean, you say, you know, they only last for 2 years, but 2 years is quite a long time. And then they can be re-extended for another 2 years, and then another 2 years for up to 6 years. So, you know, at their most extreme, they are quite extensive intrusions into people's liberty. The question would be whether those extreme powers would actually be used with relation to any particular person, because the idea really seems to be that the court will have the freedom to kind of craft some sort of range of controls in order to protect society while the person's here, while at the same time trying to create opportunities to reintegrate them through sort of programs to try to remove any risk that they may pose. So it's partly preventative, partly reintegrative.
What is the threshold for attracting one of these? Because this is the Greens' concern, that you've been a protester, I don't know, in China or somewhere, and been labelled or put on a terror list somewhere for your political activities. But in the legislation that's proposed, what's the threshold for this applying to you?
Well, the first thing to note is that the definition of terrorism under the legislation isn't what other countries say is terrorism. Rather, it's what our Terrorism Suppression Act calls terrorism. So if another country says, or another country has convicted someone for some sort of behaviour and have labelled it terrorism, what would be required is for our court to look at what that other country is saying or what that other country has convicted the person for and ask, does that actually meet our definition of terrorism under the Terrorism Suppression Act, which is, you know, using violence or threats of violence in order to try to cause the government to change its activity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, to take a concrete example, Greenpeace sent a boat up into Russia to protest against Russian oil drilling, and the Russians arrested those people, called them terrorists, and kicked them out of the country. Now, if one of those people was a New Zealander and then came back to New Zealand, this legislation couldn't be used against them because what Russia has called them as terrorists just doesn't match what we say is terrorism. So on that point, I think perhaps the Greens are slightly wrong, to be honest. The problem, though, is that even under our definition of terrorism, where the bill does rely or does allow other countries' evidence to be used directly to apply the legislation. So, for instance, if a French or a Belgian court has convicted someone of terrorism, which matches our definition of terrorism, that in and of itself then allows the act to apply to that person. So we kind of rely on other countries' courts to get it right when they convict people of things that we would call terrorism as well. And there's reason to believe that, you know, other countries don't get it right.
What is our minimum act that qualifies as terrorism? Is merely belonging to an online group, sharing material, expressing certain views sufficient?
So the proposed bill extends out the sorts of activities that are regarded as supporting or as facilitating terrorism. So being part of a group and facilitating that group's actions, knowing or having good cause to, you know, believe that you're doing so is helping that group to carry out terrorist acts, even if you don't know which particular act will take place, would get caught by this act.
Funding? Funding, for example.
Yes, funding. Funding definitely would.
And who determines what qualifies as a terror group? I know the US has its list. How does New Zealand determine what qualifies as a terror group?
Well, we also, under the Terrorism Suppression Act, have a list of groups that we have designated as being terrorist groups. But the Act makes it clear that the group doesn't have to be a designated terrorist group for you to be designated as for you to be caught by the Act. It's enough that you support a group that does carry out terrorism, whether we've designated it as a terrorist group or not.
How does this dovetail with domestic terror legislation? Does this apply specifically to New Zealand citizens coming back from overseas, engaged in acts that have occurred overseas?
It applies to anyone coming from overseas who is engaged in such acts. So it would catch Mark Taylor, for instance. Well, let's put it this way. People are suggesting that it would catch Mark Taylor. Of course, we actually have to go through a process to determine whether it would or not. It would also, for instance, capture probably Ahmed Zawi, who people, listeners may remember from the 2000s, was an Algerian refugee seeker who was accused and had been convicted in Europe of having supported terrorist acts in Algeria. He was actually locked up in New Zealand for several years because of that, and it turned out that the evidence for that was very, very tenuous, and he's now a citizen. So we're concentrating on New Zealanders who will return, I guess because they are sort of, you know, front and centre at the moment. But the way the Act's written, it isn't constricted just to New Zealanders. It's anyone coming from overseas, which would capture refugee seekers as well.
Does that also mean deportation is in play for those who are not New Zealand citizens?
In the sense of New Zealand, people who've come to New Zealand have been accused of this?
Correct.
Well, yes, deportation would be, but of course if they're refugee seekers and deporting them back to a country would put them in risk of harm, death, etc., international convention prevents us from doing so.
Well, so has the court in a recent precedent-setting case, hasn't it, in the case of China seeking the return
exactly.
of someone facing alleged criminal offending, not terror-related, mm-hmm. and the courts here said no because of where they would be returning to. Which brings me to the courts and how the judges would make this work and make these decisions without any precedents to work with, Andrew.
Well, that essentially is the nub of this. A lot of it rests on the courts as being the overseers of both the information that's been used to apply these orders, in other words, deciding whether someone is the kind of person who needs to be controlled. So that requires the court to look at the evidence that the Commissioner of Police will put before it to determine, you know, has this person actually been involved in terrorist activities? Will they really be a threat in New Zealand and so on? And then having weighed up that and decided that, yes, this is a person who ought to be controlled. The court then has to determine what sorts of controls are necessary to kind of protect society and reintegrate them back into society. Now, that put a lot of faith in a high court judge. And, you know, high court judges are, you know, high authority figures. They're used to, you know, making calls like this. One of the questions, I guess, is going to be whether the high court will be quite deferential to the police whenever the police put this information forward and say, well, okay, if you think there's a risk, you know, I'm going to go along with it rather than, you know, risk that harm caused to society, or whether the high court judges will be quite strict with us and go, well, hang on, you're asking me to put quite strong controls of an individual who hasn't actually been convicted of any criminal offending here. I want to see really strong evidence that it's necessary. And I guess we just don't know in advance which approach the courts will take. And in fact, different high court judges may take quite different approaches because they're human beings and, you know, they differ in the way they deal with these sort of things.
The focus has been on Mark Taylor and his expressed desire to come back to New Zealand, as well as his videos and other material that is online that gives us some indication of where he's been and what he has or who he has been aligned with. But we do know from the little we have from our intelligence agencies that there are a small number of New Zealanders believed to be in this region that is now entering into a state of flux, and the possibility that some may find opportunities to make their way back. The question is whether any of those New Zealanders are perhaps women who have gone there who may be part of the Al Hall camp or other camps, and would they be treated differently necessarily?
Well, it's hard to know exactly who's out there, and I think partly this may be what lies behind this, that the government may know of some people out there that they're worried about coming back. I mean, frankly, Mark Taylor, I mean, if he's the worst that's out there, then, you know, I don't know that's so bad. He strikes me as being, you know, somewhat incompetent, and I don't know that I'd be that worried about him as a future threat. But there may be others out there that the government know about who they feel are more concerning, and there may be the known unknowns, that, you know, there are people out there who we just don't know about yet who may end up back here.
Well, recalling the phrase used by the SIS, I think, that they ended up apologising for, there's the prospect that some young women are among those numbers, right, who went to Syria.
Yeah.
And therefore, we're in the situation again, aren't we, of each case being so different and such a high level of discernment going to be put in the hands of first the police, but then second the courts.
Exactly. And particularly with young women who've gone over to be, involved in ISIS or similar groups, but not actually actively participating in the military conflict, it'll be really interesting to see to what extent merely being there and providing, you know, if you like, domestic support in a family home situation for people who are involved actively in fighting, whether that is captured by the legislation. And, you know, that starts to stretch things out quite a bit. I do think, though, what adds another layer to this is the Australia issue, in that there may well be a number of New Zealanders who've been living in Australia for most of their lives who've gone over and got involved in this.
They may get caught by deportation, to be blunt. And we have done some reporting on the efforts by an Australian group of families to bring back women and children. We are aware and have been told and have reported of at least one child born to a deceased New Zealander who is potentially stateless. And I don't think anyone's going to be talking about applying the law to them. But the question is whether one way or another there could be some among those young women and children who end up via Australia coming back here. I'm curious about the age, and Australia saying that the age should be lowered. Is there a logic to 18? It lines up with the law. But if this is about, you know, exceptional measures because of the fear people have been radicalised or are involved in activities, do they have an argument about lowering the age?
Well, of course, the point is at 18 you are beyond the state's reach under any sort of controls on children. So people under 18 could still be subject to Orangi Tamariki type controls or something along those lines. I think the other thing is that, if we're going lower to, 16, 14, as has been suggested, we start to get into quite difficult questions about what is it that we're trying to achieve, really? You know, are we trying to say that 14 and 16-year-olds are so threatening and so dangerous to society that we're going to put these really tight clamps on them, even though they're still just kids? And is there a better way that we can try to integrate and sort of, deal with them as children rather than treating them as fully grown adults who've made their decisions, and because of their bad decisions, we're now going to vest consequences on them? And, I guess that, what kind of society do we really want to be, it comes down to.
What would be the process by which anybody who is in this part of the world and has been in any way associated with these groups could make their way back to New Zealand? If they can get themselves in the current and potential looming chaos of northern Syria at the moment, if they can somehow get themselves to a country or a place where there is New Zealand consular assistance, is that basically all they need to do? At that point, there's a level of responsibility on New Zealand.
Well, we've got a legal obligation to issue such people with travel papers to enable them to return to New Zealand if they want to. They are still New Zealand citizens, and so I guess ordinary consular assistance in terms of, whether there's any financial help them to get them back, I just don't know about that. I don't know to what extent New Zealand helps our citizens who find themselves broke overseas to fly back to the country. But certainly in terms of providing them with the paperwork necessary, the New Zealand government is obligated to provide them with that if they can get to a consulate and ask for it.
Thank you, Andrew. Really appreciate it. Andrew Geddes, University of Otago, Professor of Law.